You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, we remember the upcoming 75th anniversary of D-Day with a story about a Nebraska journalist who risked his life to go behind enemy lines. And we also honor the 1969 members of the 185th in Sioux City who returned from Vietnam this week, 50 years ago. But first, we take a look at the looming hike in tariffs on U.S. commodities like soybeans. If China and the U.S. can't come to terms on a trade agreement, Iowa's senior senator says he's disappointed with the escalating trade tensions between the U.S. and China. Republican Chuck Grassley stands by the president's efforts, pressuring China to align its trade practices with global expectations on intellectual property and other issues, but says increasing tariffs on soybeans and other agricultural products hit farmers hard.
Farmers are hurting the last few years, and the main reason is oversupply and overproduction, but trade is also adding to this problem. The tariffs in trade, that is.
The senator says he supports a proposed second round of relief payments for farmers, but would rather see a quick and successful end to trade negotiations with China. This week, 4th District Congressman Steve King stopped by the Siouxland Public Media Studios, and we discussed the tariff situation. King says he feels for the farmers hurt by tariffs and wants a quick resolution, but adds that the stealing of intellectual property by the Chinese also needs to be addressed.
We've lost a lot of manufacturing to China and lost a lot of intellectual property. The Chinese have made it a state industry to steal the creativity of America and Americans and steal our patents and our trademarks. And so that has to stop. And that's somewhere between $300 and $600 billion a year, every year. That's billion with a B. And so you take $1 billion, say you take $100 billion, and you go for a 10-year budget window, which we talk about, that makes, say, if it's $100 billion, I'll say $100 billion becomes a trillion in 10 years. Mm. And so that's what we're looking at, is trillions of dollars of U.S. creativity stolen by the Chinese, and there are four times the population of China. So they could theoretically replicate our creation four times if they're going to match it up with their population. In any case, it's got to stop because we can't stay ahead of China if they can steal it as fast as we can create it. And that is what's going on. I've been over there to leverage the Chinese and trying to negotiate with them and get them to stop stealing our intellectual property. I was convinced that it's a cost of doing business to wine and dine members of Congress in China. And so I wrote a bill that would fix it about 12 or 14 years ago. The president likes it. I don't know how far they are on this at this point, but I'm not particularly optimistic that we get this done. We had our negotiators went to China the 30th of April on about May 9th, I believe it was. The Chinese negotiators were here. That's closing up to a close of business on Friday. The president more or less said, we didn't get the deal done. We thought we would. We didn't. Now I want to put tariffs on more products, $200 billion worth of products coming from China. The Chinese will say, well, we're going to retaliate if you do that. So this trade war continues. And
What would you say to like a soybean farmer? They seem to be the hardest hit by this and low prices too.
Well, there's a couple of things that are hitting our grain producers, and soybean and corn prices are almost record low by right now. And I'd say to them that, you know, I want this trade deal done. I am speaking to the White House with as much emphasis as I can, and I try to dial it down in the public as much as I can because I don't want to see the Chinese point and say, well, Steve King said this weakened, that would weaken, consider it could theoretically weaken the president's hand. I want the president to have a strong hand, but I want a deal. And that's pretty much where our producers are. They were willing to take this pain, but now we're into the second year of this, and they're ready to start recovering some of their net asset that they've spent. We've been spending out of equity in agriculture in a lot of areas. So let's hang in there and get it done. I don't want to just sacrifice and give the Chinese a trade negotiation victory and think it's going to fix. Another thing that's hurting our soybean producers and our corn producers is the African swine fever that has hit so hard in China. 2 weeks ago or more, they said that the equivalent of the entire pork production of the United States has been euthanized in China with African swine fever. That's a lot of hogs. But those hogs now, they're dead and buried in China. So that all that breeding stock and all that would be part of those numbers. That means one thing is the pork markets have picked up
right. Because
somebody's going to
fill
that.
Yeah.
The other side of it is there aren't as many hogs in the world to eat the protein from our grains. So that hurts our grain markets. And that's so it's a kind of a double-edged sword there. But I do think in our pork producers, not as many of them own their own hogs these days. There are a lot of custom feeders out there. So when the pork market picks up, the people that make the money off that aren't as often the people that are living on our farms out on this land as it used to be. And it more goes into the pockets of the large producers that are subcontracting the livestock feeding to our working farmers. I've been involved in every bilateral trade agreement that's come down in Congress for the last 16, 17 years. I've traveled to most of these countries to do all I can to secure these trade agreements. And I think of some of them from Australia, South Korea, Japan, China, to the extent that that's worth something. Taiwan, I've gone to Taiwan twice and sent 6 of my staff on individual trips. Only one staff goes at a time. Taiwan pays that trip, by the way. And that has helped us bring a really good grain deal for Taiwan, and most of that comes out of Iowa. So I escorted them across the state last fall, and I wanted them to see our grain production. We really focused on that. So we've got a really good agreement going on with Taiwan. I want to keep those relationships up. There's another piece that I can only say a little about, and that is that we've set up the beginnings of a trade agreement with a large country in another part of the world that would be a private sector exchange. It wouldn't be negotiated through our trade negotiators. It would be our grain producers that can certify the source of that grain came off of this farm and went into this bin, and we can put it together so that the quality of that grain can stay top-notch and consistent all the way to the end user. The end user has already been into Iowa, and we have escorted the end users to introduce them to a whole number of producers that we had. And if we get this done, we'll be packaging up supplies of grain that go down the river on barge, and those barges will be tied up down at New Orleans. And then that grain that's sourced back to the land will all go on a shipload, and instead of them blending in the foreign material down there and making a mess out of our good grain, that grain gets to the end user as high quality. If we can do this, then it is a bigger deal than the Taiwan grain agreement, and it'll pay premiums and dividends for, we think, 30 years is the time frame of this agreement. If we get this done, you can be confident I'll let people know.
That was 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King talking about tariffs on American commodities like soybeans and corn. For John Heisdorfer, the tariff situation hits very close to home. The soybean producer from Keota in southeast Iowa is the chairman of the American Soybean Association. Heisdorfer says it's been more than a year since the original retaliatory tariffs from China took effect, and soybean farmers have had a hard time unloading their stores.
Well, you know, we've got this huge stockpile sitting here ready, and we're about to put some more in the ground if it dries up sometime. I think it's starting to be, I don't know if that's the right word, but emotional drain that we have this on and off, you know, of we think we're coming to the end of this. Thing with China, but yet it goes on.
Some of the senators, especially Senator Charles Grassley, say he's really hoping and pushing for a decision to be made and a deal to be struck with China. But I don't know. Do you ask yourself, is President Trump really listening to elected officials, especially, you know, from Iowa?
Yeah, because I hear the same thing, and I think Senator Ernst is the same way. She wants to get rid of these tariffs so we can get some of these agreements made, with UMCA, you know, Mexico and the Canadian one. It's being very very tough, I think, on them too. They want to be sure that they support the president, but yet they don't 100% fully agree with him.
Did a lot of farmers that you know vote for President Trump?
Well, I assume so. Voting is kind of a private thing, so nobody talks, you know, a lot about what they do. There's a few, of course, outspoken people, but the word is that the farmers put him in office, so I guess we go with that.
Do you think that subsidy payments, more payments like came in last year for farmers, do you think that that would help? Is that, that's really kind of a short-term fix.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We would rather have open trade than we would a payment. The payment last year, of course, did help a lot of people. Being able to go to their banker and say, "Hey, you know, I've got this much, you know, payment I can put towards my expenses," and maybe got them, you know, another year of operating loans.
Do you think that soybean farmers, some of them might actually stop farming soybeans, might take up something else, grow some other crops, although that would be a big change and probably an expensive one?
It would be probably a more expensive crop. Plus, I don't know that there's anything out there that's really making any money. You know, most everything is we're getting less than our cost of production. So not sure that would play out either.
Do you know of any farmers who say that they might have to get out of the business?
I don't know of any personally around me, but I know that it's happening in some of the other states where things have maybe escalated a little more, as in the dairy business and those type of things. Or if folks had a really wet year last year and didn't get much of a crop, and then they're looking at the same thing this year.
Has there been a situation in the past where tariffs have caused this kind of disruption?
Well, I don't know that it's been tariffs. I know there's been a couple, with Carter and one with Nixon. But I don't think it was anything quite this large. And we'd worked on these exports, at least to China, for 35, 40 years. Farmers have put money into it. And so that makes it a lot bigger deal than maybe what those were. Those were really, they turned into be longer term because of a backlog of crops and things. But they were really, as we look at it right now, short term compared to the amount that China takes from us.
That was John Heisdorfer, a soybean producer from Kyoto in southeast Iowa. He's also the chairman of the American Soybean Association. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. There are still thousands of would-be immigrants at the border of U.S. and Mexico. After more than a year of mass migrations from Central America and Mexico, the lines began to swell last year when the Trump administration limited the number of asylum cases it accepts each day. Immigrants experienced similar issues from the 1920s to the 1960s, when strict quotas on immigrants from Southern Europe kept large numbers of asylum seekers out of the country. These quotas reflected the belief of the pseudoscience of eugenics that rated some people as better, smarter, and innately more moral than others. In his book, The Guarded Gate, author Daniel Okrent delves into eugenics and immigration. He says eugenics sprang from some new ideas about genetics, propounded in part by Charles Darwin in his book, The Origin of the Species.
Until then, people believed that we all derived from Adam and Eve. And if we all derived from the same parents, then we're all related. But once evolution shows that we're not all related, well, then there's distinction. Then there are races that can be explained. Then there's the hierarchy of some people being better than other people. An Englishman named Francis Galton, who happened to be Darwin's cousin, propounded this theory of eugenics that if we know that people are of different quality scientifically, we should breed the best to the best and make a better Great Britain. He even had the idea of getting the 5,000 best young men and young women in Britain, putting them in arranged marriages, having Queen Victoria preside over the marriages in Westminster Abbey and giving them an annual stipend so they wouldn't have to work for a living. They would only work at making better babies for an improved Britain. Now, this kind of loopy idea, and I say loopy because even if they had done it, it would have taken something like 250,000 years to actually change the nature of the population, leapt across the Atlantic around 1900 and began to be applied to new people coming into the U.S. A man named Charles Davenport, working out of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory on Long Island, was the one who really led the movement in the U.S., and he came up with a notion that was slightly different from Galton's. His was a version of negative eugenics. Not only should we breed the best of the best, but let's keep the worst, the least of the least, from breeding if we really want to improve our civilization.
And in the book, you show examples of how families, whole families, and people in the families would be examined and classified and these on little cards, and it would put, you know, specific areas where they were positive or negative.
Right, and it ranged from such things as intelligence and height and health to things like appreciation of music, color perception, power of their grip. And these were all surveys that were done by grossly undertrained people who, in fact, not only learned these supposed important facts about the individuals they were interviewing, but also about their parents and their grandparents and their neighbors. And they would ask, well, the grandfather of the family next door, what was he like? Well, we all knew he was a drunk. Well, therefore, that goes into their record. When this nearly a million such records of Americans were finally unloaded by the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory shortly after World War II to the University of Minnesota, the university said, this is all worthless. It was so scientifically questionable.
But people, especially progressives at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, Margaret Sanger, were proponents of this, and they wanted the right people to procreate.
That's true, to varying degrees, and at varying times they might change their mind. But it was in many ways a very kind of classically connected to the progressive movement. The progressive movement was based on improving society and having government do it on the basis of science. Well, the problem with this is that the science wasn't really science. It was junk.
But it took a while for people to discover that.
Yeah, what it took to discover that is the rise of the Nazis, who took this idea and distorted it in horrible ways. But before that, the immigration laws in the United States were radically changed in 1924 to accommodate this eugenic theory of the world. It expanded from what Davenport saw to not just let's keep out individuals who are deficient because they're feeble-minded, as the term was, or they're epileptic, or they're blind, or they're deaf. Let's keep out whole ethnic groups, or races as they were then known, because they are collectively inferior.
And these are groups that had historically been, you know, what would be the right word? I would say these are groups that historically had been seen as lesser when they came into the United States.
Well, if we think of the nature of the immigrants that we know from documentaries and from photographs of Ellis Island, they were poor people escaping
right.
really horrible conditions in Europe, from southern Italy, from the Russian Empire. Jews in the Russian Empire had been confined to live in one area. Their jobs that they could no longer have, they couldn't be in the civil service. In southern Italy and in Greece, terrible, terrible economic conditions led to great hunger. They had reason to leave, and when they arrive here, if you imagine you're a well-established Boston or New York aristocrat and you see these people, you recoil because they are so different from you. They are unlettered. They are uncouth. They speak a guttural language, that motivated the entire anti-immigration movement. It was a fear of the stranger.
So this law, the 1924 Immigration Act, how did that act address immigration in terms of the numbers of people and the kinds of people that were allowed to come into the country?
Well, I'm going to give you one preface to that, which is in 1921, Calvin Coolidge, about to be sworn in as vice president, publishes an article in all of all places, Good Housekeeping. And he says, now that biological laws, those were the key words that he used, biological laws have proven that these people are inferior, we have to keep them out. Well, biological laws of this nature didn't exist, and there was no proof. It was theory that was adapted to presuppositions that people already had. So by the time we get to 1924, there was a clamor for immigration laws to keep them out. Now, the mechanic that they used was a quota, that they would install a nation-by-nation quota, and it would be based on the number of people from each nation of Europe that were already present in the United States, so that if one country, country A, if 10% of the population of the United States was from country A, then 10% of the immigrants could be from country A. Then they lower the number of immigrants who can come in to 160,000 a year and apply these quotas. Now, you would think they would use the recently completed 1920 census, but no, they didn't want like that one. So they went back to the 1890. They used the 1890 census to determine the composition of the American public. And the reason why they picked 1890 is that that's when the large immigration from Eastern and Southern Europe began. So they cooked the books and installed numbers so radically out of whack with reality that it could only be seen as pure discrimination. By way of example, in 1 year before the 1924 Act, 222,000 Italians came to the U.S. Once the quota was imposed, it was fewer than 4,000 a year.
Wow, that's a big drop.
Yeah. And that law stays in place until 1965, 41 years, through the rise of the Nazis, through the devastation, the economic devastation of Europe from the Depression, through the Holocaust, through the years of the displaced persons camps that were stretched across the map of Europe. People from these countries were fundamentally kept out. At the same time, large quotas for people from England and Germany and Scandinavia, all ethnic groups that had come earlier, went unfilled. They had quotas so large there weren't enough Britons or Germans or Swedes or Norwegians who wanted to come under them.
And today we look to the southern border and we see so many people who want to come to the United States. It seems very similar. I know you talk about that in the book.
Well, it's similar and it's different. The key way that it's similar is when these distinctions are made on the basis of nationality. So when the president says, we don't want any more Central Americans, he's not saying we don't want any more people. He's saying specific people. We don't want any more Muslims from the Middle East. Very specific people designated by their ethnicity, not by their individual qualities. Not let's keep out the criminals, let's keep it out all of them because they might be criminals. And in that sense, it's very much like the 1924 law.
When you look at the immigration law today, what do you think could be done to make it more equitable?
Well, there are no quotas today. There's a ceiling. There's a maximum number of people who can come in a given year, plus refugees. And you know, the refugee processing system is, frankly, a mess. I think that people on both sides of the issue would agree with that. And there are people who know far, far more about this than I do, who have worked in ICE and who have worked for the Justice Department and Homeland Security. So then we need many, 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 many more judges to make these determinations of whether people qualify as refugees. Let's not categorically refuse them all, and let's not categorically let everybody in, but let's have a process. Let's have a system and base it on the experience of the individual, not on the experience of the nation.
That was Daniel Okrent, the author of The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. On May 14, 1969, members of the 185th in Sioux City returned from a mission in Vietnam. Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer has more on the activation of the 373 airmen.
The 174th Tactical Fighter Squadron, a unit of the 185th Tactical Fighter Group, spent a year at Phu Cat Air Base in South Vietnam.
They were working hard, and these are all incredibly complicated close air support, so they're right in there in harm's way.
That's the new wing commander of the 185th Refueling Wing, Colonel Mark Muckey, who goes over a list of the group's achievements.
12 Silver Stars, 35 Distinguished Flying Cross, 30 Bronze Stars, 115 Commendation Medals, and 300-plus Air Medals.
Three members of the unit died, including one pilot killed in action, Warren Brown.
And I saw the smoke coming out of the belly of his aircraft and knew he was hit and he was in trouble.
A memorial in front of the Sioux Gateway Airport was rededicated in July of 2008, 40 years after Brown's death. His colleague, retired Captain John Haley, spoke at the special service.
We'd gone from the cornfields of Iowa to a hot fighting war. But we didn't have time to fool around with surreal, really, realistically, because we immediately started checking out combat missions.
Haley says the airmen did receive better treatment in Siouxland than other parts of the United States.
And the people in Siouxland gave us a parade. And I don't know anybody, and I've probably talked to 100 or more military people of that time, and nobody got a parade.
A military milestone of a conflicted conflict, remembered with honor by the current commander of the 185th.
We're very proud of the service that they did 50 years ago, and I think the thing we discussed today is that's who we were 50 years ago, and that's who we are today. The same great airmen executing the mission around the globe.
For Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Captain John Haley gave a speech during the rededication service of the Lieutenant Warren Brown Memorial on July 14, 2008. The ceremony took place in the main terminal of the Sioux Gateway Airport. In about 5 minutes, he summed up the unit's service and support found here in Siouxland for the 185th.
It's really a joy to see this crowd. When we originally dedicated this 39 years ago, I think there might have been 50 people and two-thirds of us were in uniform. And it was a time of great turmoil in the country. Vietnam was a horribly emotional issue. And fortunately, this country has learned, I guess, or discovered or realized that you don't blame the warriors for the war. And they haven't done that in a long time, and thank heavens. And I'll have a little bit more on that in a moment. The 185th deployed from here on May 14th, 1968 to Phu Cat Air Base, Republic of South Vietnam. 3 days after we took off from this runway out here, we landed in Vietnam, which was a little bit surreal. We'd gone from the cornfields of Iowa to a hot fighting war. But we didn't have time to fool around with surreal, really, realistically, because we immediately started checking out combat missions. And about 2.5 weeks later, all the pilots were checked out and we were flying a mission or two every day. 2 months after that, on July 14th, Warren and I were in a flight going to the Ashau Valley in the northwest corner of Vietnam on the Laotian border. In South Vietnam, the Ashau was a very ugly place. There were no missiles. We never saw any missiles in the south. There were no fighter aircraft enemy, but there were guns, and there were guns, and there were guns. And in the previous 2 weeks, our wing had lost 3 airplanes to the guns of the Ashau Valley. And we went back, which I won't say it made a lot of sense, but we went back. We were on our second pass, and Warren Brown was hit. And he said, 3 is hit, and that was the last thing he said. I learned a long time ago that in a single-seat airplane, if you have got problems, if you're in trouble, yeah, there's number one, you don't have time to talk on the radio. Number two, there's no point because nobody can do anything for you. You are just too busy trying to get out of trouble. Shortly, there were about 5 intermittent layers of clouds, so we didn't see him well. The last time I saw him was in a mirror, and I saw the smoke coming out of the belly of his aircraft and knew he was hit and he was in trouble. But about that time, I punched into the clouds and didn't see him again. Excuse me. I may get a little emotional here. Anyway, he did eject, and we didn't know precisely where. We figured we'd see him the next day. Well, there was some malfunction, and it was fatal for Warren. And they found his body, the rescue people found his body the next day. I have 3 points I want to make. There's an expression that's, as far as I know, fairly new about military people, and it reflects back to World War II, World War I, probably any military engagement we've ever had. And it is that all gave some and some gave all. And probably Day gave about as much as anybody who's alive, but Warren gave all. He gave his life, he gave everything. And he and 58,000 other young people in Vietnam gave their all. And that's basically why we're here today, to honor him and inclusively honor them. My second point is the 185th is and has always been one of the outstanding Air National Guard units. I met some of the finest people I ever met in my life in the 185th, and one of those was Warren. He was among the best of the best. The 185th tradition continues, and I and a lot of you are, I'm sure, very proud to be or have been members of it. And my third point is, I mentioned the turmoil in the country during the Vietnam War. GIs got spat upon in airports coming home. We came home, and the people of Siouxland gave us a parade. And I don't know anybody, and I've probably talked to 100 or more military people of that time, and nobody got a parade. And so I don't know if anybody ever thanked the people of Siouxland for the parade, but the people of Siouxland are the same quality as the 185th, fine, finer and finest. And thank you very much for the parade and for being the people you are.
When Captain John Haley returned from Vietnam 50 years ago, he said, "It's the 4th of July, Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's Day, and my birthday, all in about 15 minutes." 25 years before those Vietnam vets came back to Sioux City, the Allies were preparing for the D-Day invasion that effectively signaled the end of Nazi control of Europe and World War II. Many Iowans and Nebraskans served in the war. Some of them were journalists. One of them that may have been forgotten in recent years was Barney Oldfield. The University of Nebraska-Lincoln graduate coordinated a group of journalist paratroops who dropped into Normandy behind the lines 6 days before the D-Day invasion.
6 hours earlier, 13,000 U.S. airborne troops also parachuted in against German gunfire. With them went six war correspondents, recruited by Nebraska and U.S. Army press officer Barney Oldfield. First, the journalists had to endure 15 days of physically and mentally grueling Army airborne school. Then they had to survive 5 successful parachute jumps. All this for a chance to risk their reporting lives and for the first time ever jump into combat with U.S. soldiers.
That was UNL professor of journalism and documentarian Barney McCoy, who recently produced that segment on Oldfield on Nebraska Educational Television. He's working on a new documentary about Oldfield and other journalists who served in the war with him. McCoy says the name Barney Oldfield may be known to some as a famous early race car driver, and he found out that Barney did have a connection to the original Barney Oldfield.
My understanding from reading through his papers is Barney Oldfield had a distant relationship with the Barney Oldfield, the great race car driver of the early 1900s. Barney Oldfield, the race car driver, was the first human being to drive 1 mile in less than a minute. And so that was his claim to fame. And then Barney Oldfield, the race car driver, actually had some parts in early silent films he was also involved in. But in one way, shape, or form, when Barney Oldfield was born in Tecumseh, Nebraska, his father said, "You know what? I'm going to name my son after the first Barney Oldfield." And interestingly enough, they actually had a really good relationship. They stayed in touch with each other They had met each other when Barney Oldfield here was a reporter for the Lincoln Journal back in the day. And that's where the relationship really sprang up. And they stayed in touch through the rest of the earlier Barney Oldfield's life. But
now he went to UNL. He got a degree in journalism. And then he worked at the newspaper there in Lincoln, right?
Very good, yes. And he loved entertainment. He had always been fixated on becoming an entertainment reporter and wanting to go to Hollywood, and actually was kind of like the Nebraska Bureau reporter for one of the Hollywood newspapers for quite some time, and he would do movie reviews and that kind of thing. But yeah, he was really very gifted as a journalist. And when World War II came along, he enlisted. He became one of the first to be trained as an airborne Army soldier. And when World War II came along, was a public information officer who helped to work with the correspondents who all wanted to be involved in the reporting of the D-Day invasion.
I just think it's interesting, you know, going from interviewing Clark Gable and Shirley Temple and doing this sort of Entertainment Tonight radio show out in Hollywood to then going to work with Dwight Eisenhower.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think he was attracted to not just celebrities, but to people who were very influential. He had a great deal of reverence towards Dwight D. Eisenhower and towards the generals that he reported to in the airborne, and ultimately had been able to convince months before the Normandy invasion on June the 6th of 1944, what if we could somehow recruit some war correspondents that would be willing to go through airborne jump school, go through the training, complete successful jumps, so that they would actually be able to fly with the airborne hours before the kickoff of that invasion and parachute behind enemy lines and be there and report as the airborne soldiers attacked from behind.
You know, when I watched some of the report that was on NET about Barney Oldfield, and he said something to the effect of, if you didn't know what fear was, you would find out when you were standing there, you know, waiting to be, you know, shoved out of this plane over Normandy. You knew.
Absolutely. And to put that into some perspective for you, those planes were flying in at very low altitudes, and it was pitch dark. And they would look out that open door, and the only light they would see was the light of the moon on that night and the arc of the German tracer fire firing from the ground, trying to pick off as many of those paratroopers in the air before they hit the ground as they could. And that's what they were jumping into. So if you talk about a literal leap of faith, it was.
I couldn't help but think, just from a reporter's point of view, maybe today young reporters don't know how heavy a typewriter is. He had a typewriter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had a typewriter. In fact, it's sitting behind me here in my office. And it's the same typewriter that Barney had since the early 1930s, when he first began writing as a cub reporter for the Lincoln Journal here in town. And it went with him around the world. Everywhere he went, it was one of those, you know, extremely portable typewriters. But as a paratrooper, before they even began recruiting correspondents, he wanted to jump with that typewriter to see if it would withstand the force of, you know, jumping out of a plane and landing on the ground. And that was the prototype that they used to prove that, yes, in fact, a correspondent could jump with their typewriter and make it and be able to, you know, report and get dispatches out once they hit the ground in France and beyond, all the way into Berlin.
I hadn't realized that they were doing, when I first read this, they were going before. They had to go through enemy territory. Is that right? That sounds extremely dangerous.
Oh, yeah. No, they were parachuting into enemy territory. And there was active battle, combat going on from the moment they hit the ground. The Germans knew that the Allies were coming. They didn't know exactly when. They didn't know exactly where. But they had prepared all kinds of defensive positions on the ground. Part of the airborne invasion also included gliders that the Germans had put up, these huge stakes along the ground in Normandy so the gliders would hit these stakes and be destroyed. They had flooded fields to keep the gliders from being able to land, or if paratroopers landed, they might drown. So they had really done a good job of trying to dig themselves in. They knew that there was going to be this onslaught. There was no secret that this invasion was pending.
So they landed.
Yeah. They did.
And they got through, and they started sending reports. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. All six correspondents were able to make it back alive. One of the correspondents broke his leg, but that was the worst of the wear and tear that happened. He broke his leg when he parachuted and hit the ground awkwardly. But they, from the get-go, Bob Rubin was the first of those correspondents to be able to hit the ground. There were roughly 13,000 airborne paratroopers that jumped in the early morning hours of June the 6th. And Bob Rubin was in the very first plane of the hundreds and hundreds of planes that ferried those paratroopers over into the battlefield. He was number six to jump of the 13,000 that jumped. General Maxwell Taylor was number two.
It seems incredible that at that time, the amount of danger that not just Americans, but English, French, all of the allies were willing to go through and risk their lives because of the threat to all of our way of lives here.
It was really interesting because Dwight D. Eisenhower knew that this was going to be an incredibly risky and costly operation. And he visited with many of the airborne soldiers before they actually took off from that airfield. And very frankly, had instructed the men that, you know, many of you will not come back from this operation, and thanked them for being willing to really make that ultimate sacrifice. You know, we talk about that term ultimate sacrifice, but when you really watch it play out in the letters and the descriptions that you hear from people like Barney Oldfield, but more specifically from the correspondents that landed in Normandy and were reporting on what they saw, it's a very, very powerful, powerful part of sacrifice.
There's a great story that I saw in material about this particular mission that Bob Rubin, who you mentioned before, who was an Omaha newsman, he sent a message via carrier pigeon. Is that right?
You know, he had parachuted in. He decided, I can either land in an open field where the Germans will see me and perhaps shoot and kill me, or I can go for the orchard. I'm going to go for the orchard. So he lands in this orchard, and he's now hanging about 5 feet off the ground. His parachute is stuck in the tree, so he pulls out a big knife and he cuts himself down. And in darkness, all of the soldiers were given these little clickers. They called them crickets, and that's how they would identify themselves to each other. They would, you know, those little clickers, you click them on and they kind of make a cricket sound. And so that's how they would identify themselves to each other, that they were friendly and not enemies. So, you know, they're going through this darkness with these little clickers, and somehow he winds up jumping into a trench with General Maxwell Taylor. And, you know, and now they're trying to get to this village where they need to take out and secure a bridge. And they're going through all these things. And let me see, I've got it right here. So now Rubin is saying, as we dog trotted along one stretch, I noticed a soldier with a couple of cartons tied around his neck. They contain carrier pigeons. I talked him out of a pigeon, scribbled my first story, fastened it to the bird. We shooed him into the air. The story got through, the first story written from liberated France, and it was published throughout the world under the slug by carrier pigeon.
This is almost Game of Thrones stuff, you know, with the ravens.
Yeah. It's just, it is. It's just amazing. And of course, that carrier pigeon had to fly 150 miles back across the English Channel through enemy fire itself to be able to get to that pigeon coop where that message was given to Barney Oldfield, who could then share that with the world. So,
what did Barney do after the war?
After the war, for a while, he was back in Hollywood as a press agent for Warner Brothers. And then he was recruited to go actually and work for the Air Force as part of the, I think he was out in Colorado with a wing of the Strategic Air Command, and spent the rest of his career until he retired, I think in the early 1960s, as actually a member of the Air Force. Although during World War II, he was an airborne and he was an Army officer. So, but you know, then ultimately after that, he was in private industry for a while. But Barney really believed in the importance that journalists played in being the independent ears and eyes, observers, to be able to tell the world what was happening. Particularly on the battlefield in remote locations around the world. And that was something that Eisenhower also strongly believed in, that, you know, that the having a reporter write in a newspaper article or make a broadcast and personally report on the efforts of the men and the women who were, you know, leading the Allied fight, it was huge for morale, not just on the battlefield where some of these soldiers would read their names or hear about their units, and knowing that the people back home were being informed about what they were doing, the sacrifices they were making, but also the, you know, the husbands, the wives, the fathers, the mothers, the brothers, the sisters, everyone back in this country who were desperate to know, you know, what their sons and daughters were doing as they fought in the war too.
Often we hear stories about people that were heroes, but we can't connect with them so easily. I mean, here's a guy from a little town in Nebraska who went to the University of Nebraska. He feels like someone, anyone that we might have known or our grandparents would have known.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, again, Barney, people described him and all, and they go, oh, you know, we could never tell. He was like the P.T. Barnum sometimes. You know, he was a great storyteller, and sometimes we had to try and figure out where the fact began and the myth ended. But he was really determined to make sure that journalists were represented. You know, he was a co-founder of the Radio and Television News Directors Association back in the early 1960s. But, you know, something else that I think that was really important to make notice of is that Barney never forgot his origins here in Nebraska. And he and his wife, Veda, raised millions of dollars that have helped to fund scholarships for students to this day here in this college and across the university for people that otherwise wouldn't be able to attend college. And I also thought it was really classy. A lot of those scholarships were named on behalf of some of the first American soldiers from Nebraska that died in the Normandy invasion.
I know you're working on a documentary. Is that right?
Yes, my next objective is to take this story and to expand it and build on it and more completely talk about the role that these correspondents played as they not only landed in Normandy, but certainly in the case of Bob Rubin, went all the way to Berlin in the pivotal battle, the Battle of Berlin, which ended the war effectively in Europe.
That was University of Nebraska-Lincoln Professor of Journalism and documentarian Barney McCoy. As he says, he's working on a documentary about the journalists who worked behind the lines in World War II. And that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks to Sheila Brummer. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.